you'll have the bio of Will McCants, who's a fellow at the Brookings Institution at their Center for Middle East Policy. And Will has his first book was called Founding Gods, Inventing Nations, Conquest, and Cultural Myths from Antiquity to Islam. Who's the publisher of that, Will?
Princeton.
Princeton University Press.
Keep it in the family.
Keep it in the family, yes. Will McCants, take it from here, and then we'll get everybody in to the discussion.
Thank you.
I've already
much.
Got five people on the list, so if you want to get in, folks, let me know.
All right, thank you for having me. If we make it off the record, does that mean it's going to be more exciting for the audience? They're going to be really primed for some juicy bits.
We'd like to have it on the record.
It's going to be on the record. It's fine. So I'm just wrapping up a book on ISIS, and one of the questions I've been wrestling with is why the Islamic State is so brutal. It engages in mass executions of enemy soldiers, but also civilians. There are numerous instances, even before Iraq, of the Islamic State dumping civilians into mass graves. They harshly implement Islamic law, at times implementing laws that they don't even implement in Saudi Arabia, which is the gold standard for ultra-conservative Salafis. So I was trying to understand, in doing a history of the Islamic State since its founding in 2006, why it's so brutal, because I don't think the answer is obvious. And it's also a puzzle, because I think it strikes many outsiders that being this brutal is counterproductive to establishing a state. If you brutalize the people that you want to govern over, they are going to rebel against you. So why do something that on its face seems so counterproductive? I don't think we can explain it just as a function of war. There are a number of ultra-conservative Sunni rebel groups that are fighting in Syria and Iraq. They don't behave the same way the Islamic State does. The Islamic State is particularly notable for its brutality. So it's not merely a function of war. I don't think, by the same logic, that it's merely a function of religion. There are, again, many ultra-conservative Sunni rebel groups that are fighting in Syria and Iraq that are not as brutal as the Islamic State. So it's not purely a question of theology or jurisprudence. From its founding, the Islamic State has rejected the conventional wisdom that you need to win over hearts and minds, that you need to win over the hearts and minds of people to conduct a successful insurgency, and that you need to win over the people in order to maintain whatever sort of government you need to establish. From the Islamic State's founding in 2006, and before that when it was Al-Qaeda in Iraq, it rejected this basic premise. And I think it goes against the conventional wisdom in the United States about how you conduct a successful insurgency. It certainly goes against the conventional wisdom of how you conduct a successful counterinsurgency. But I think most people don't know that it also goes against conventional jihadist wisdom. And that's what I want to spend this talk on, is looking at the debate within Al-Qaeda when the Islamic State was part of Al-Qaeda over this question of, do you need to win over mass public opinion in order to successfully prosecute an insurgency and establish and maintain a state? Let's go back a little bit to the late 1990s, the early 2000s, when the young Jordanian thug, as Bernard rightly called him, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, travels to Afghanistan because he wants to set up his own shop. There's an interesting story of this fellow, Saif al-Adl, that Bernard mentioned, who is in Kandahar, and he hears that Zarqawi has shown up. And because Saif al-Adl is a former special forces colonel in the Egyptian military, he's learned to be pretty cagey, so he has Zarqawi followed. And it turns out that Zarqawi is a pretty extreme person, as we all know today. But in sussing him out, Saif al-Adl discovered that he was at odds with the other jihadists, particularly on the question of the Shia and who is a legitimate target for an insurgency. Zarqawi was far, far to the right of al-Qaeda. We're used to thinking of al-Qaeda as the big bad, but when it comes to waging a war in Muslim-majority countries, they appear quite moderate in comparison to someone like Zarqawi. So there is this discussion between Zarqawi on one hand and bin Laden and Zawahiri on the other hand. And they decide that they are not going to join forces at that time because Zarqawi is too extreme. But bin Laden and Zawahiri give Zarqawi a little bit of seed money to set up his own camp. So that's the beginning of the relationship between them. And as Bernard said, when Afghanistan collapses in the face of the U.S. air power and working with the Northern Alliance, Zarqawi flees to Iran and later makes his way to Iraq when it looks like that's where the United States is going to go next. So he begins to pre-position a number of cells in Baghdad and in surrounding areas. So the war kicks off in 2003. Zarqawi is trying his best to foment a civil war. They're carrying out attacks on the United Nations, you'll remember. They carry out attacks on a Shi'i holy site in Najaf. He writes a letter in 2004 to al-Qaeda's leadership proposing a merger. But in this letter, he lays out his plan for how he is going to prosecute the insurgency in Iraq. And he asks al-Qaeda's leaders, do you agree with this? And if you agree with this, I will be your liege man. I will sign up under your banner. But here is how I'm going to do this. And one of the things he talks about in particular is his desire to go after the Shia, particularly Shia civilians. His thinking being if he can provoke the Shia into an overreaction where they begin to kill Iraq's minority Sunni population, the Sunnis will have to turn to Zarqawi's group for protection. So he's seeking to provoke a civil war. Bin Laden and Zawahiri are a little bit nervous because, again, this is a major difference between them. Bin Laden and Zawahiri, you'll see throughout the presentation, their thinking is always on how do we build and sustain a popular support for our project. That is key for them. How do we win over mass public support? For Zarqawi, it's quite the opposite. He is going for the support of a very small section of society. And so they deliberate on whether to take him on board or not. Informing them or informing their decision is the fact that they have just tried to wage an unsuccessful insurgency in Saudi Arabia, where they try to go against the United States, but they end up fighting against Saudi security forces. It's a PR disaster for them. Their organization collapses in Saudi Arabia. They are looking to get into the new hot thing in jihadism, which is the Iraq War. Zarqawi is presenting an opportunity. They ignore their better judgment, and they sign him up as a new al-Qaeda affiliate. So al-Qaeda in Iraq is born. Al-Qaeda's leaders quickly have buyer's remorse. And there's this great letter that Zawahiri writes to Zarqawi in 2005, and he is urging him to rein in some of his more excessive practices. But in particular on this question of the Shia, he's saying, okay, you can go after government officials, that's fine. But killing normal Shia civilians is going to make life hard for us, because they're going to come after us. And it's also a public relations disaster. And this is always uppermost in Zawahiri's mind. It's a public relations disaster. In the same vein, he argues that the beheading videos have to stop. These things, while technically you can execute a prisoner if you must, don't broadcast them. Again, these are public relations disasters for us. Stop broadcasting the beheading videos. And then finally, on the question of establishing an Islamic State, al-Qaeda very much wanted to see an Islamic State established in Iraq. But al-Qaeda's leaders, bin Laden and Zawahiri, urged Zarqawi not to declare a state until two things happened. One, that the Americans left, and two, that they had won over the vast majority of the public, the Sunni public, to their project. Again, al-Qaeda's leaders, their head is always focused, they are always focused on building popular support for their cause of establishing Islamic State. So these are in the instructions. Stop going after Shia civilians, stop the beheading videos, build popular support before declaring a state, wait for the Americans to go. Al-Qaeda in Iraq does none of that. It continues with the beheadings, it continues going after the Shia, and most importantly, it ignores the advice for winning over popular support before declaring a state. They go ahead and they declare a state in 2006, despite owning next to no territory, and then they proceed to brutalize the population in trying to implement their control. One of the things that they do in order to suppress the Sunni population and to bring them under control is they begin to implement the Hudud laws. The Hudud are the fixed laws that are prescribed in Islamic scripture, most in the Quran, but some in the Hadith, the words and practices attributed to Muhammad. These are the laws that you're familiar with that, that Saudi Arabia implements. The Islamic State tries to implement those. One, as a way to establish their ultra-conservative bona fides. We are putting in place these laws, some of which go beyond Saudi practice. But two, as a way to control the population and terrify them. The problem is they are religiously out of step with many Sunni Iraqis who don't want to see these laws implemented. Two, they terrify the Sunni population who begin to turn to their tribal leaders for protection. And this is sort of the background to the growing Sunni awakening in Anbar province and the rebellion against al-Qaeda. By 2008, al-Qaeda in Iraq, then by then the Islamic State, has utterly failed. If you are going to measure the performance of a terrorist group by the bounty put on the head of its chief executive, the bounty, I think, on Abu Masri's head, who was Abu Ayyub al-Masri, who was the actual head of the Islamic State, the bounty on his head in 2007 was, I think, $5 million. By early 2009, it's gone all the way down to $100,000. And it's just sort of marks the decline in the fortunes of the organization. They had become not just a failed state, they were never really a state to begin with at that time, but also a failed terrorist organization. And they become an object lesson to analysts on the outside of what not to do. And it seems to ratify the conventional wisdom of you need to win over popular support to establish a state. You don't want to brutalize your population or that's going to turn them against you. And interestingly, those are the exact same lessons that al-Qaeda's leaders took from the failure of the first Islamic State. We know this because of a number of secret correspondence that has subsequently come to light through various means. But if you look at the way bin Laden assesses what happened in Iraq, it lines up almost perfectly to how Western analysts were thinking about the Islamic State's failure in 2008-2009. Bin Laden says the Islamic State should have worked more with the others, particularly the Sunni tribes. It should not have been killing Muslim civilians of any kind, but especially not Sunni civilians whose support they needed. It needed to be more lenient in applying Islamic law. It had been too harsh. And it needed to tend to the economic well-being of the people whom they proposed to govern. And we see this advice bin Laden begins to give to the other al-Qaeda affiliates who, inspired by the Islamic State, were trying to set up their own states just after the Islamic State's collapse. So in Yemen, al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula makes an attempt to establish an Islamic State. and it tries to follow some of bin Laden's advice. One area it does not follow it is in implementing these Hudud laws. And it later comes to regret that it had been too harsh in its implementation of these laws and not lenient enough. When al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb or al-Qaeda in North Africa tries to establish its own state in northern Mali, you'll remember the invasion there in 2011, the head of al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula writes their head and says, hey, here's what we learned. You need to be a lot more lenient in applying these laws. Really try to win over the people. The head of AQIM instructs his commanders to do it, but it's too late. They've already been pretty brutal, and they've squandered what little popular support they had. Again, we see this around the same period of time, the Shabab, which was at that time a secret affiliate of al-Qaeda, was not a publicly declared affiliate of al-Qaeda. They try to do the same thing. They are too harsh in implementing the laws. They don't look after the economy well enough. And you have a fascinating series of letters from bin Laden where he is telling them, be more lenient in applying the laws, look after their economic well-being. If you did not know the name attached to the letter, you would swear it was a USAID employee. He tells them what kinds of trees to plant, what sort of taxes to impose. He has a very laissez-faire attitude towards businessmen. Nevertheless, none of them quite follows the advice, although some of them try harder than others. You would think, and with good reason, that looking at this body of experience, the jihadists would tend to side with bin Laden on these things. You know, all of these states have tried and failed. Maybe bin Laden has it right. Maybe we do need to be more lenient in imposing these laws. Maybe we do need to look to popular support. The problem is that they can never really answer the question satisfactorily. Why? Because being global jihadists, they are always provoking an outside intervention. And so this always disrupts the experiment. Even if they are more locally focused, like the Shabab, the fact that they have global Islam jihadist rhetoric invites foreign intervention. So the experiment is always short-circuited. And each of these groups that I mentioned talk about outside intervention as the main reason why they collapsed, with good reason. They were the main reason why they collapsed. But it never quite settles this debate. Could we have made a real go of it if we had hewed more to bin Laden's vision or more to the Islamic State vision? It's unclear. The Syrian civil war provides a new opportunity to test the theory again. And it's an interesting experiment because what you have are two groups that are part of al-Qaeda but go their own ways. You have Nusra, which was a branch of the Islamic State.
You spell that?
N-U-S-R-A. You have Nusra, which was a branch of the Islamic State that set up shop in Syria. But it begins prosecuting an insurgency the way bin Laden and then Zawahiri wanted it prosecuted. They are working with other rebel groups, even sometimes the Free Syrian Army. They are very careful, especially after the first few months, not to kill Muslim civilians. And in the areas that they control, they are very leniently applying Islamic law. So they're not breaking anybody's fingers for smoking or what have you. The Islamic State goes the opposite direction, especially after it finally breaks with al-Qaeda over the question of who controls the territory of Syria. The Islamic State does not want to work with other groups that don't sign on for its state-building project. So it's unwilling to just embed itself in the insurgency. It wants to establish a state. It is far more ruthless in killing anyone who defies its writ or criticizes it. And they are very harsh about applying Islamic law in the areas that they do control. So, why be brutal? You could look at their own explanations, and then you could look at some of the success that they've had to try and understand why a group would continue to be brutal in this way. One reason is that, according to the Islamic State's thinking, this kind of brutality has the political effect of deterring one's enemies. Now, they may be delusional on this point, but in one of their chief strategy documents, a book called The Management of Savagery, which is one of the main books on how to conduct an insurgency that they circulate in Islamic State camps. In that book, there is an extended discussion of the value of brutality in war, especially as a deterrent to one's enemies. And if one's enemies are being ruthless against you, you have no choice but to be ruthless against them, or they will never back down. It is very much against the hearts and minds approach. The secret to winning, this author argues, and the Islamic State believes, the secret to winning is to be more brutal than the other guy. Another reason to be brutal is because it scares the hell out of potential opponents, especially people on the ground. You will remember that when the Islamic State, with just 1,000 fighters, rolled into Mosul, with some of its local tribal allies, that the Islamic, the Iraqi army and the local police forces fled. Tens of thousands of them fled. Why? Because they were terrified. They had been watching videos of what the Islamic State had done in Fallujah and other cities they controlled to military personnel and to the police. These videos circulated by hand and also online. We have media reports that for many of the people who fled, they cited this as the reason that they left. They weren't going to stand and fight against that kind of enemy. The other thing that you might guess at is that this kind of brutality can be very efficient in the short term. You can quickly subdue a population. And if your goal is to establish your own state, not overthrow an existing state, this can be a very politically effective tool in the short term. In the long term, of course, it breeds resentment, but in the short term, it can be quite useful. Harshly implementing Islamic law can also be useful. It's a signaling device to show all other ultra-conservatives that you mean business, so it's helpful for recruitment. And it is also a way to subdue the population who are terrified of being the object of these punishments. You also have the side bonus of attracting recruits who like this kind of stuff. There is a reason, there are many reasons why they film the videos that they do. If you look at the one of the burning of the Jordanian pilot, I mean, it was intended as a deterrent, but it also has the effect of exciting young men and women who think that kind of violence is cool, and they want to be a part of it. So you are selecting then the kind of recruit that you want to have to prosecute the sort of war that you want to prosecute. Now, there is a problem here that Bernard alluded to, and the problem is that to prosecute this kind of war as a religious organization that claims to adhere to scripture, you have a problem because some of those scriptures cut against the kind of war you want to prosecute. So you have lots of statements from Muhammad, who waged his own insurgency campaign and set up his own government, which is why he's turned to as a model. But you have a number of statements from him not to go after non-combatants, particularly the elderly, women and children, not to destroy private property, not to burn apostates. You have a number of rules then in place that would hamper this kind of insurgency. So what do you do if you've made the strategic decision that this is the way to win, but religiously you are bound by some of the scriptures that you claim to adhere to? What do you do? Well, you find other parts of the Islamic tradition that will support the kind of insurgency you want to wage. You can draw on a verse in the Quran that talks about reciprocity, when your enemy will not stop attacking you, as Bernard said. You can find minority opinions in Islamic law that might ratify what you want to do. But the point is, they want to maintain maximum flexibility for maximum violence, because this is what they've decided is the most effective way to mount an insurgent campaign. Almost done. Isn't it obvious, though, to outsiders, isn't it obvious that this kind of insurgent campaign and this way of governing, isn't it obvious that it will not work in the long term? And this is something I wrestled with when I was writing the book, because it goes against my own conventional wisdom about how to conduct this kind of insurgency. I think one thing to bear in mind before you answer the question for yourselves is, number one, for jihadists, remember, this question never gets resolved, because there is always outside intervention, because global jihadists invite it because of their rhetoric. So the question is never solved. Even after this current conflict, the question will not be solved, even after the Islamic State's government is defeated, which it will be. But the question won't be answered, because it was an outside invasion that did it, and not necessarily a popular revolt on its own. There are also historical examples that one could point to where this kind of campaign works. If you go to the Middle Ages and you look at the experience of the Mongols in the Middle East, this is exactly the kind of campaign they waged, far worse. If you look a little bit closer to the modern period, and this is something that Bernard could speak to much better than I could, but if you look at the three attempts of the Saudi state to establish itself, they waged a very similar kind of campaign. And it was politically quite successful. The reason why the first two states did not take, but the last one does, is because the last guy who tried it realized that if he stopped pissing off his powerful neighbors, he might have a shot at maintaining the state. And then more recently, if you look at the example of the Taliban, who used the same sort of methods to set up a state, and it was the fact that they provoked outside intervention and not a rebellion, that's the reason why they were ultimately overthrown. So my worry then is, looking at the contemporary experience of the Islamic State, my worry is that the jihadists will look at its political success for many of the reasons that Bernard cited, the fact that the Assad regime gave them a pass, widespread Sunni discontent. But my worry is that the jihadists will look at the example of the Islamic State and they will take the lesson that it is better to have your enemies and the population fear you than it is to be loved. And I think we're going to be, for the next few years, we're going to see much more brutality in the waging of jihadists' insurgencies across the Middle East. Thank you.